This show is sponsored by the Crummy Cookie Dough Company, top-notch humans making top-notch edible cookie dough.
The following contains descriptions of violence and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please be advised.
People look at you today, 20 years later, and they still have no idea what you're about. Tell me in a sentence who you are.
I'm nobody. I'm a tramp, a bum, a hobo. I'm a boxcar and a jug of wine and a straight razor. If you get too close to me.
Welcome to I Am Everything, with your host, Shion, 8 Town.
Well, I have returned, live and in color. You are listening to I Want You, She's So Heavy by the Beatles. And tonight will be a very special episode. Tonight we're talking about Charles Manson. Yes, the Charles Manson. And this is a story you have not heard before. This is a story that will take the old story and flip it on its head. I'm joined by a man who's from Las Vegas, Nevada. One of the very first people I ever met from Las Vegas, Nevada. That tells you how big my circle is. But now he resides in Los Angeles, California. And he has done his research on Charles Manson. And we'll get into all of that. His name is Sean Michael Elitis. So, I guess, without further ado, here it is.
Welcome to I'm Everything on CKMS 102.7. And today I'm going to do something, this week I'm going to do something a little different. Usually every week I interview someone, and I am going to interview someone. However, this episode is going to be mainly based on Charles Manson. But before we get to Charles Manson, it's going to be a whole episode of Charles Manson. So I don't know if he has kids out there. Hopefully they're listening. We'll get to that as well. First, I'd like to introduce my guest. Who are you? What do you do? And where do you live?
I'm Sean Michael Elitis. I'm a photographer, filmmaker living in Los Angeles.
That's the dream, being a photographer and I guess just being an artist and living in California is probably the dream. When did you get into doing photography?
I mean, I've been doing it a really long time. So, I mean, my first horrible attempt at photography was probably right outside of high school.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's been a minute.
You're probably working with like DSLRs and digital cameras, but now you're working with like old school cameras, I believe, right?
Yeah. So originally I shot on film, I think I took like a photography 101 class or
right.
At that time we did do it on film, but it was so like, I mean, when I say I was terrible. I had no idea what I was doing. And yeah. There's lots of concepts that were very foreign, but yeah, so that was fun. And then I never really touched film again,
yeah.
like shooting on film until, maybe like 5 years ago. So from that point, I went to digital, stayed digital, took some film classes. And that's really like in film classes is where sort of
right.
I started getting introduced to like composition rules and
yeah.
different things like that. And that really started to like, you know, spark the photography interest like in a bigger yeah. way. I also think I had just like a terrible, that my yeah. photography 101 teacher was just awful.
Yeah. And do you find like digital photography now is kind of overrated? Because I feel like everyone now is a photographer, really, but they're not.
You know, I like that it's open to everyone. And from that, you kind of get some like new ideas in the pool. And, you know, it's like you can see all types of like just new mm-hmm. stuff. I mean, for me personally, like the photographers that are influences and had a major impact on me all shot on film. So that's more of, I think, like just sort of like an artistic choice. And I enjoy the process of shooting on film a lot more.
Yeah.
It kind of slows things down and you kind of can you know, you can do it with more intention in some ways, or at least you're motivated to do it with more intention because right. you're limited to, you know, if you're shooting medium format, you got 10 frames. If you're shooting 35, you have more, but you know, every time you end the roll, you have to pause what you're doing and reload and that whole thing. So
yeah, I think that
you have to think about it.
I think the old school cameras are actually coming back though. Like I do see a lot of old school type of photos being taken, and I think that's pretty cool to like actually reteach yourself, because I feel like learning on digital is pretty easy for the most part, at least if you have a Canon. Like I think for me, I used to do concert photography, and I'm not talking about like shows, like punk shows. I'm talking about like concert, like stadium, you know. And I think that I thought that was okay for the most part. And then I kind of got into like portraits, and then I was living in a big city, and you know, it's funny. I had these cards made, and they're so cool. They're black, and my name is in white, but my like the T in my name, A-Town, is like a cross. So when you turn it over, it's just like an upside down cross. And then I moved to a small town, right? I'm like putting those out, and obviously people in small town, they just aren't as open-minded, so they think like it's part of like some cult or something. So let's just say I haven't had business yet.
Is that stuff on your Instagram? I like your photography a lot, but I don't know that I've seen the concert stuff.
It's not. Oh, well, actually, I kind of got rid of a lot of the stuff on my Instagram. But yeah, no, I'll definitely shoot a link about that. It was kind of cool. I got some couple cool shots, like Will Smith's daughter, when she was singing, like she was singing about something like she loved, and she put her hand on her heart, like just a quick second. And it's like, I was like, oh, it's those shots, right? Cause
oh, you got it.
I was like,
snagged it.
And like other things too, right? So there's another photo where Ty Dolla Sign is smoking a joint. And then he's like, who wants these? And all the girls are like, me. And then he is going to give it to them. And then all the hands are like, all these girls' hands are reaching out and getting it. And it's just for a split second. I was like, clip.
I was like, oh, that's cool. Yeah. That's really cool. How has that influenced like your portrait shoots? Do you use any of that mentality in your portrait shoots?
Well, I mean, for the most part, like I kind of, when you know how to do concert shots, or even like in your case, like small venue shots, like punk show shots, you gotta know when the right time to catch it is, because they're always in motion, right? They're always moving. So I feel like once you harness that, you're able to do like portrait shots and also like dark, like shooting someone in the dark rooms or something, you know. It's like once you harness that whole like concert atmosphere, you could kind of bring that anywhere else and make them do like crazy things, like jump up and down or something, and just catch them in that
totally.
Moment. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, digital is so much better for like low light.
Right.
So like on film, it's like, you know, but I mean, it's cool because you can take like black and white film, and in development, you can push it so far. So yeah. You could even take like 400 speed film and push it to like to over 100,000 ISO. Like I shot some street photography in Paris and like no light, kind of like that. And yeah, you can still get some great images that way.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, my favorite thing about like doing concert stuff, I never did like the bigger venue type stuff that you're alluding to, but I would do like shows where like I knew the punk band, or like was friends with like a friend of theirs, and like I would just go on stage and get right up in somebody's face. So that was kind of the part of it I liked. It was like you're just in the middle of this chaos, and
I think there's one thing that you do that I respect people who can shoot in black and white. Like I will never do that, just because I feel like it's, I mean, it depends, right? It depends if you have like an old school camera or a digital camera. A digital camera, I would never shoot in black and white, just because it doesn't look right. And the blacks don't look black. And also like, I just feel when there's color into it, it kind of adds to the photo, it adds to the art. But it's different, right? When you shoot an old school black and white, it's like night and day, I think. It's from digital. Digital is, you could tell it's not real black and white, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, there's like some, I guess there's some considerations with it. Like, so with black and white, it makes you hyper aware of like what shadows are actually doing, like what kind of shapes they're making, because all those shapes are influencing the composition. And I typically end up doing like very high contrast stuff, so I can get like, you know, really deep shadows. And so those lines become very important, where before I was doing that and I would walk around, I wouldn't necessarily, like, I don't know, be like paying attention to shadows. It's almost like they were kind of like non-existent or something. But once you start doing that for a while, you become like hyper aware, like all these shapes kind of all around you. And then in color, you know, it's sort of like there's just so much. It adds like a whole other element of like color theory, which is such a rabbit hole. I just got a good book called An Interaction of Color. That's worth checking out. But it's a whole other whole other world. And, you know, you can't necessarily control it other than what you put in front of the frame, or if it's a shoot, you could, or if you wanted to just go through very elaborate color correction. Which is fun, you know. It's like if you want to dive into that. I think with film though, what's interesting is it's like it's a different you're dealing with, you know, so Kodak developed all kinds of different film stocks, right? And over time, certain film stocks became appealing to the eye. Like certain film stocks became like more popular than others based on how they reproduced color.
Yeah.
And so you had like all these years of like going through that experiment to arrive at what's pleasing to the eye. Cause they don't show every color like exactly how it is. There's like certain films have like, you know, like greens are more vibrant, or reds are more vibrant, et cetera, et cetera. And so through that whole experiment, you kind of get the benefits of having that pleasing color.
Yeah.
Now there's like lots and things that people will apply to the digital image to help kind of mimic that or whatever. But yeah, it's kind of a cool place to start if you're into that. Like, and again, I'm not against digital. Like I like both. For me personally, it's just sort of I'd rather explore film just for all the reasons we stated before.
Yeah. I mean, I think when you throw up, like an old school film or something, but it's made recently, I think people kind of appreciate it more. Like you see a lot of Quentin Tarantino's films. I think they're made by, you know, those old school film. I think he only puts them out like one time. Like Hateful Eight was put out once in theaters and you can only watch it for one day. And I think people appreciated it more because you can kind of see like, okay, this is different from watching a movie made and with new technology.
I think there's something to be said for like imperfection, because it's like obviously on film, like especially like motion picture film, like every frame might not be aligned, let's say, exactly perfect if it's on if it's being projected in a theater, and there's like and there's lint and there's like what scratches and whatever else. And I think anytime you start to remove reality from something, it helps you kind of engage with it in a way that like you turn off sort of like that, some like sensor in your head. It's like, is this real? Is this not real? What is this? And you kind of can go into like a more, I don't know, perhaps like more of like, not a dream state, but something like approaching that.
You ain't no dancer. Your head is scaled up.
the slide, and I stop, and I turn, and I go for a ride, and I get to the bottom, and I see you again. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But do you, don't you want me to make you?
Was Beatles Helter Skelter, which segues us on to the Helter Skelter group, the man known as Charles Manson, who I share my birthday with. I didn't know Charles Manson right away in my life, but I found that out like later on in my life. I was like, well then, okay, November 12th. I don't know that I'm not saying like I think like him. Yeah, at first I was kind of like into him, but then now I'm not, just because I was like, why? Wait a minute. He was like, he was trying to get rid of anyone that wasn't white. I was like, why do I like him? I don't like Nazis. So, you know, one day I just decided I don't like him anymore.
Thank God.
But, you know.
Yeah.
But you know more about him than I do, even though I share a birthday with him. You know more about him than I do. So I watched a documentary yesterday. It's called The Lost Tapes. And it was very interesting because it had like older Manson family members, like two or three of them. And they're mm-hmm. watching footage of themselves, which I thought was so bizarre. Like she's seeing herself naked and she's like old, like what, 50, 60 years old.
Yeah.
And like that documentary was very interesting because it showed like clips of the members being like.
Was that Diane Lake? Who was the woman? I can't remember. It's been a while since I've seen that one.
Yeah, okay. It was Snake Diane Lake, and then the 14-year-old girl, the one who was like brought in as when she was 14. I forget what her name is. She has like a weird face, but she was one of the members as well, and she was talking about how when she first got into the family, she wanted to like hook up with Charles Manson, and Charles said, "Yeah, sure, let's hook up and lose your virginity." And Charles ended up raping her, and she's like, since then she didn't ask him, like since that day she didn't ask him to have sex with him because,
right?
He said, yeah, no, ask me to. So
which brings up a great point, which is what you're alluding to is, Charles Manson, for the sake of this conversation and beyond, was not a good person in any way,
No.
So, my interest in like. The Manson murders in general just happened because I read Helter Skelter, and anybody who reads that and kind of thinks about it just walks away with, this doesn't make a lot of sense.
Right.
And so from there, you kind of just go down what seems like an endless rabbit hole of, you know, speculation and myth and reality. And yeah, it just kind of keeps going. A lot of the footage from that, from the Lost Tapes, was from a documentary, which is, I don't think you didn't have a chance to watch it, did you?
No.
I think it was 73?
Yeah, I will dive into that.
Okay, so basically what ended up happening is when the Manson family got arrested, that filmmaker basically went and lived at the ranch and made a documentary about the entire family. And so it's just crazy that that exists. And it was very much set up like kind of like a real, you know, documentary film. They would like light certain scenes and they would stage it and this and that. And it's really interesting. Two things are interesting. If you read Helter Skelter and watch it, you're gonna walk away with one interpretation. More recently, there was there is an author named Tom O'Neill who he wrote this book Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s, which we'll get into. But if you read that book and then watch the documentary, you're gonna have an entirely different interpretation.
So what questions still linger? For the audience that wouldn't know.
Well, I mean, the motive for one, and just quickly, and I'll get off the Manson doc.
Yeah.
But they screened it at Tarantino's theater out here, maybe a year or two before Once Upon a Time came out.
Yeah.
And they had the director, like in person for a Q&A. They usually do Q&A. So they projected the film on 35, and they had the director for a Q&A. And I was like, oh. Right. Thank God, finally, somebody can make sense of this whole thing, because the big thing is motives and everybody's interpretation of the event. Like if you listen to, I mean, just pick out of the hat anybody, what the prosecution says, what the murderers say, what like everybody around that whole group had such like a different story, even if it was like multiple people in the same room. And so you're left with like what really happened, which is like, I think why it just lingers on, because it's like people hear it, it doesn't make a ton of sense. And you're like, well, what really happened? And then there's that, you know, just rabbit hole of information.
Yeah.
So at the Q&A, it's like you hear the director start to talk, and I don't know him. Like, I don't know much about him other than, you know, the movie, but, you know, at some point he starts like talking about like, I don't know, being involved with like Area 51 and going to that base or something like crazy like that. I don't remember exactly. I was just like, ugh, it's like, it's all lost, you know, like, just never going to know.
Right. But, and I think a cool thing about that footage was that it kind of it was raw. So, and you kind of encompassed how the families felt about Charles Manson, even talking to Denise Lake or Snake or whatever her name is, and she was watching herself and they were saying like, so what'd you think of Sharon Tate's baby? And she's like, I don't know, like she had like basically she when she was pregnant at the time as well, and she said Sharon Tate's baby is my baby now. And she's like watching herself say that, she's like, I look like a monster talking when I'm younger. But she was in denial, I guess. But it's like so cool watching that, like it's like you're back there with them.
With that, what's your interpretation of the Manson murders? And maybe for the audience, maybe describe like the major bullet points of the Manson murders, just so I can know where to jump in and see where we should dig into. Yeah. So, and even if you're wrong, if like it doesn't matter, like I'll kind of jump in. But what's your interpretation of what they did, what happened, and what was Charles Manson's involvement in
it? So here's my thought: is that I don't know if it's proven, but they could be one of the first cults that has been documented. So Charles Manson, you know, gets out of prison and he meets up with one of the Beach Boys. I forget his name.
Dennis Wilson.
And they're like, he's living with him and they get an argument. So Dennis kicks him out. And then I guess Manson, you know, I feel like he's always been kind of a messed up guy, right? So he takes it to heart. He takes it so hard. So then, you know, he creates his own family. They find a ranch, which I would love to visit one day. Do you know where that ranch is, by the way? Have you ever been, or do you know the location?
I do. Are you talking about, there were actually two ranches. So originally it was the Spawn movie ranch that's featured in Tarantino's Once Upon a Time, which is probably a good place to look at, because I believe they shot on the location, and, you know, from the footage, it looks pretty good.
Right
from the Manson doc, it looks pretty well recreated. So
And the ranch is still kicking, huh?
No, that ranch is gone. Yeah, there was a fire. You know, I don't want to say the wrong thing because I don't remember exactly, but it was more recent. There was a fire there, and since then it's been sort of destroyed. I could be also confusing that with the other ranch they went to after the murders, the Barker Ranch, which also has been destroyed. So
yeah,
Google that.
That'd be so cool to go to if it was still around. But so yeah, so basically what happened is that Manson heard a Beatles song about pigs, and he, instead of thinking about cops, he's thinking about celebrities. Celebrities are pigs. Like, we got to kill all these pigs, right? So then they find Sharon Tate, the house where Sharon Tate was staying at, which I think was the gentleman for Beach Boys. I'm bad with names. It was his old house, I believe. And they go there, they kill all of those people. But really what was supposed to happen was Charles Manson told Tex to kill the producer of Beach Boys, and that was it. But whenever they went to the house, it was a whole bunch of people. The Charles Manson family wrote pigs on the wall, you know, and the rest is history.
I mean, there's kind of two ways to go about this because, you know, originally, if you're kind of going by, you know, the gospel of Helter Skelter,
right?
You know, what you're saying up until, like, you know, he gets out of prison, he does pretty quickly start to get girls to follow him around and that whole thing. And he does get involved with Dennis Wilson, and he ends up at Terry Melcher's house and meets him, and obviously isn't happy with him when he doesn't help him with his career. So that's all true. But he did write and record some, you know, some good music and some awful music at that time period, which maybe we should jump into.
There's a time for living. The time keeps on flying. Think you're loving, baby, and all you're doing is crying. Can you feel? Are those feelings real? Look at your game, girl. Look at your game, girl. What a mad delusion, living in that confusion, frustration and doubt. Can you ever live without the game? The sad, sad game. You can't be true. You can tell those lies, baby, but you're only fooling you. Can you feel? Are those feelings real? Look at your game, girl. Oh, look at your game, girl. If you can't feel and the feelings ain't real, then you better stop trying.
If you haven't already, you really need to check out the Crummy Cookie Dough Company. They're in Uptown Waterloo, but you can get their stuff on DoorDash, Skip the Dishes, Uber Eats, and through their website at the Crummy, that's C-R-U-M-B-Y, cookiedoughco.com. What are they? Well, it's funny you ask. They're Raw Cookie Dough Company. You could eat them raw, or you could cook them, but it's always responsible ingredients you recognize and respect. Ran by two powerful women that just love the feel of 1960s vintage and 90s hip hop is totally awesome. So cool. So go check them out. Wonderful women, and you'll love it just as much as I love it too.
And we're back with Sean, and he knows all too much about Charles Manson. Maybe a little too much. No, there's no such thing as knowing too much about something unless it's Q and A's. But
I want to know more.
Yes. And yeah. That was Charles Manson. If you guys didn't know, yes, Charles Manson used to sing. My girlfriend didn't know that the other day. Charles Manson, yes, he sang, and it was at the Beach Boys studio, whatever studio they used to record at. And like, yeah, watching the documentary, that's the gist of what I got from the cults themselves.
So, I mean, Dennis Wilson was like kind of into the scene. There was lots of drug use. Like, they were living at his mansion, Manson and the girls. And so he was getting the benefit of, you know, living with a bunch of women and sex and that whole deal, you know. But eventually this like anarchy erupts with that group, right? Obviously. And, you know, by that point, you're kind of introduced to exponentially day by day darker Manson, for reasons we can get into later. And, you know, there's like them crashing his car and like all kinds of stuff. So basically Dennis Wilson just wants to just remove himself from that whole deal. And so, you know, from when he gets out, we're talking 67 to when the murders happen, which is like 69. It's like you start to see, obviously, like increasing drug use, not great living conditions. And then all of the first moments of violence within the family all start to come out of what appear to be just like drug deals gone bad. So in like, I want to say it was like early July, maybe it was like around the first, like somewhere early in the month, Tex Watson, whose first name is Charles, but they called him Tex, he was involved in a drug burn with a guy, Bernard Lots of Papa Crow. And basically, he ripped this guy off. He was supposed to do a drug deal. He had some money. He kind of just like went into an apartment to make a drug deal and left out the back and just took the money.
Yeah.
And the drug dealer had this girl he was seeing at the time as collateral. And so he never shows up. Bernard Crow calls the ranch and asks for Charles, and they think whoever answered the phone, I don't recall at the moment, but I thought they were talking about Manson. So Manson gets on the phone and Bernard Crow's like, look, you got to give me my fucking money, boppity boo, or I'm going to come down to the ranch and just kill everyone. And so Tex won't go because he's terrified. Manson goes down with another family member and ends up shooting Bernard Crow. And he thinks he killed him. And he also, for some reason, thought he was a Black Panther. So this is what starts the paranoia of like, oh, the Black Panthers are going to come to the ranch and they're going to kill all of us and this and that. And so that happens. Also in July, there's another murder that happens, which there's two versions of the story. One version is Gary Hinman had an inheritance of $20,000 and the Manson family wanted it. Another version is it's a drug deal gone bad again. Right. And it ends with Bobby Beausoleil, Susan Atkins, and Mary Bruner. Like, I mean, Bobby Beausoleil is the one that killed him, but Manson shows up, like cuts him, and eventually Bobby Beausoleil kills him and is later caught. I think it was 2 days before the Tate murders. But that's the reason at the Hinman murder, they did all this like Black Panther lookalike stuff and blood on the walls, is because they were trying to make it look like the Black Panthers did it because of that whole interaction before.
Right.
And that continues on through the other two murders. So regardless of where you kind of land on the motive, you kind of can start to see this escalation of violence and insanity, right?
And it's paranoia, really, at the end of the day. They're paranoid that they think the Black Panthers are going to get them. And really, the Black Panthers don't even know who they are at this point.
Exactly. So that all goes down, and like Bobby's in jail, and now they're trying to hatch a plan to get Bobby in jail because he got arrested he was picked up in Gary Hinman's car. Like, he fell asleep in his car. You know, he wasn't a good crook. So essentially there's a couple different ways you could lean here without getting into the stuff that Tom O'Neill discusses, which in his book Chaos, which is, it's to do a copycat murder to free Bobby Beausoleil.
Right.
And he kind of went to Tex. I mean, this is according to Manson, which who knows, right? So Manson basically goes to Tex and like, that situation I handled for you, you owe me one.
Right.
And so he's like, go get Bobby out of jail. I don't care how you do it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he kind of, which I don't think is exactly what happened, but that's his version of that story. And so obviously on the 8th to 9th, because it happened late at night, past midnight, the chief killers of the Tate murders, they leave the ranch, they go up to Cielo, and all hell breaks loose.
And I found that there's a couple of members who tried to get them not to go. I forget who it was, but there was one woman in particular who was like doing everything she could to get them not to go, like trying to avoid them to kill, you know, Sharon Tate and all of them. I think she was like making up lies like, oh, the cops are coming or someone's coming to try and avoid so they wouldn't kill them. But, you know, as we know, it didn't turn out like that.
It probably wouldn't be helpful to get too in the weeds there because, yeah. I mean, as you watch the Lost tapes and even if you watch the Manson doc, you know, but like, let's assume half of what was going on at the ranch was actually going on. The question would be, would you believe anybody at that ranch? You know what I mean? Because everybody's kind of saying things for different reasons. And as we'll come to find out with some bigger stuff, it's like reality is it's like you're dealing with murder, which is punishable, you know, if you have any involvement forever. So it's like you want to distance yourself in every aspect as much as possible. And then, you know, the secondary and third motive from the prosecution was like the helter skelter race war thing, and then what's your interpretation of that?
I mean, it kind of lines up with what you're saying about him and the Black Panthers. I feel like he was, and not many people would know this, and you probably know this, but Charles Manson was so paranoid that when everyone did acid, he didn't do acid. I mean, maybe he did, but he didn't do it as much as the other people did it, just so he can be in control. So this guy wanted to always be in control. So I think.
Right. Well, let's pull out some keywords there. So basically you're saying control, meaning brainwash, right? Yeah. These are like important words coming up. So Manson, brainwash, control, family. Let's put a big pin in that. So he basically had this theory around the time he was saying, which was essentially like, and he was saying this stuff, not that that's necessarily the motive for the crimes, that basically there'd be a race war, which they were, these crimes were going to ignite, and they would retreat to the desert, come back and rule the world, just to say it very briefly, like this apocalyptic thing, which, you know, Manson completely took this from Fountain of the World, which was another cult, which talked about a race war. They'd go into the desert, come back and take over the world. It's like the same thing, except he mixed in like he's got this interpretation from listening to the Beatles music, right?
Yeah.
So there's that. And then the final motive, which was like a secondary motive in the trial, was that it was to send a message to Terry Melcher, who claims he didn't have any, like he didn't think this was targeted at him in any way. And also he didn't talk to Manson during that time or after, which isn't true.
I think it's fascinating. So they go to the desert and, you know, they could have chilled there. It's not like they had DNA forensic, all the cops, like they didn't know who did it. They thought, okay, pigs, helter skelter. They didn't know where to look, really. The Manson family's chilling in the desert from what it is documented.
And then, so that all happens. And basically the following night on the 10th, they go to Rosemary and Alino LaBianca's house in Los Feliz out here. And they basically, Manson and Tex tie up the two of them and then send in two of the girls to go in, and everybody, you know, they kill them, and that crime happens. Just to go over that briefly, because we'll touch on it later, but there's more details to that. And so there's more murders after, but that's kind of takes us to what most people are aware of.
Yeah, so they're hanging out in the desert and Charles Manson burns a government car burns a government, some type of car. And the cops come and they arrest him because of, you know, arson or whatever. And at that time, they didn't know that, you know, these people were involved with the murders. But it just makes me think, like, if he didn't burn that car, do you think they would have got away with it?
So I guess real quick, to touch last thing on the Tate LaBianca murders, the idea in the trial was that they were unrelated, random. And at the time the cops didn't even think they were related, which I don't think is true, because there was all those words written in blood on the wall. It was like, you know what I mean? It's pretty easy to like see that they're done by the same people, but the idea was that they were completely random, which, is not true. What ends up happening from the raid is, you know, by this point, I mean, we're talking like, you know, these murders happen in August and they're all not arrested or charged until December. So basically, Roman Polanski put out a reward for any information leading to an arrest, which sparked a cellmate, which maybe she would have said it otherwise, but that Susan Atkins basically confessed all the details of the Tate murder to.
Right.
And so that's really what kind of did the whole family in.
Yeah.
Whether or not they would have been, you know, arrested beyond that's very difficult to know, but it's definitely possible. And you know, you're dealing with a bunch of people at this point are kind of gloating about murder. So I would assume at some point that would get out, and probably the murders would continue. So.
Yeah, and I think they probably wouldn't have last long, because I think a lot of the family was delusional to think that Charles Manson was this god. And even when he was in prison, they're like, oh, he's going to get out. Oh, he's going
to
get out.
That's a good segue, because what you have to realize about Manson is the reason they probably thought he was going to get out is because up until 67, Manson was like literally caught and jailed for everything, and essentially basically doing 7 years off a 10-year sentence for forging a check and violating probation, right? Now after 67, which this will tie into the book Chaos, and this is one of the things that always seemed weird even pre-Chaos, is Manson starts getting arrested and violating his parole like as soon as he's out, and he never goes back to jail. So he violates parole, doesn't go back to jail, violates parole, doesn't go back to jail, on and on and on. So if you're a family member and you see that happen, you're probably thinking when he gets arrested, like, oh, he's going to get out.
Yeah.
Right. But like, what was the reason for that? Who wanted Manson out on the street versus in prison?
Right. Yeah. Good question. And that's probably a question that doesn't really get answered, because I mean,
we can answer parts of it.
Right. These murders could have been avoided if he was still in, if they didn't let him out of prison, or maybe if they waited until the 80s or 90s or whatever to let him out.
So his parole officer was a guy named Roger Smith, who worked with the Haight-Ashbury, the free clinic.
Yeah.
He was a researcher there. Also, at that clinic, and Manson and the girls would go there all the time, because Manson was going there for parole related stuff and the girls were going for like STD checkup / cures. And so they were in and out all the time, 67, 68. And so also who was given an office there was this guy, Jolly West, who was completely connected to the MK Ultra program, which I don't know if you're familiar with it. This part sounds crazy. It's really well documented in the book, so just go with me for a minute.
Yeah.
So basically, the government via the CIA had a mind control program from the 50s, early 50s until early 70s. And the goal was to, I mean, there was a bunch of different objectives. One was to get people to kill and have no memory of the programming. Others were to like put in false memories, like replace real memories with false memories.
Yeah.
And they used LSD to do this. And you can like Google it, verify it, do whatever you want. Like, it sounds crazy, but this was happening. And it happened in like initially with prisoners and initially where like Manson was in prison. So when he gets out, his parole officer, I mean, essentially sends him to this clinic. Where Jolly West is, and he's the person who's sort of every parole violation getting told to send him back to jail, but isn't, like, and he's not reprimanded for it. Manson's not reprimanded for it.
That's crazy.
And so you have to ask why.
Right.
So the big question is, like, either local FBI or who knows, like, for some reason he could have been like part of an experiment. And I'm not saying the government wanted Manson and the family to go kill somebody. But when you're messing around with LSD, and back to the words brainwashing, programming, even if you look at that Manson doc, some of the family members say the words like operation, programming, right?
It's
like,
true.
Where did all of that come from?
We'll touch on more about Manson in prison, but we're going to throw it another song. So, you know, Manson has a catalog of really short, creepy songs. So I guess here's a short, creepy Manson song.
Your home is where you're happy. It's not where you're not free. Your home is where you can be what you are. They don't know how to be free, so burn all your bridges, leave your old life.
'cause you're strong in your mind. And anywhere you might wander, you could make that your home. And as long as you got love in your heart, you'll never be alone. Just as long as you got love in your heart, you'll never be alone. No, 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 you'll never be alone.
All right, so we're back again talking about Charles Manson and his very adventurous lifestyle. Charles Manson was in prison, and I thought, well, he wasn't in prison, he was on trial at the time, and they, like, the Manson family, like, cut their hair and braided into this jacket. And I went to go on Google and I want to see if that jacket was still around. Like, imagine you can find that jacket to this day.
I know where it's at.
You know where it's at?
I know who owns it. Yeah.
Really? Okay, then. How do you know them?
Because I know.
No? Okay, well, I'm gonna have to investigate that one. I'll have to see that old hair from the 60s. But so Manson is in prison, and you know, all this shit's happening. They think that he's gonna get out.
You know, I think if we get into the trial and that whole thing, we're gonna get pretty deep, when there's probably still some stuff we should maybe kind of clear up a little bit, just because it's so, like, we could go on forever.
Yeah,
but yeah, we'll essentially, I guess from where we left off, which is, and you know, it's this isn't a conspiracy theory. Through MK Ultra, they were experimenting on civilians.
Right.
There were Johns visiting prostitutes that would get basically dosed, and they would be looking through like a see-through wall that, like, what their behavior was on LSD and other things, and you know, take my word for it, Jolly West knew a lot about mind control, and in some documents revealed in the book Chaos, even how to implant false memories over real memories. So there's a lot there, and it sounds kind of crazy, obviously, if you, like, don't know anything about it. When I first heard about it, I was like, come on. But when you get into it, you know, it checks out. So assuming, and this is all going on at this clinic that they're involved in, so you have to, like, kind of ask the question, which is, like, look, if Manson and the family are just psychos and they killed everybody, so be it. But if any of them were involved in an experiment, like, against their will, which, you know, when Manson was in prison before 67, there were documents where he's like, there are these doctors visiting me, I don't trust them, I don't like them, I don't know what they're doing, blah, 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 blah. So this isn't to be sympathetic towards Manson, but it is to ask the question that's like, if that is true, like, who do you blame? And Wes never admitted to being involved in MK Ultra, even though some documents post-mortem reveal he was heavily involved in it.
Right.
So that brings us to, you know, the two more public victims of the Tate LaBianca, like, them being, like, random, and did they know each other? Which it turns out, they did know each other. Jay Sebring from the Tate house, who was murdered. He was an ex of Sharon Tate's. He was a famous hairdresser, and he's in Tarantino's flick, which is how people probably know him now.
Yeah.
He had Lino LaBianca from the following night in his address book. Like, he cut his hair, or did some business with it.
Right.
So there's that. And then the Tate residents, and this is, like, the craziest thing, because the thing there is, like, they're going to that house to send a message, and maybe the byproduct of trying to free Bobby Beausoleil, right?
Right.
And these, you know, it might be the reason we can't connect a perfect motive is there might just be multiple things going on at the same time, right? So they go to this house, they do what they do, but the night before, that entire group of people, Jay Sebring, Abigail Folger, Wojtek Frykowski, Sharon Tate, they're all at Jay Sebring's house. And he was, like, one of the first people in LA to get cable. So they were going to watch a movie and eat, and the power goes out. And so it just gets really bright and goes out. So he calls his lawyer's son, was working his way through law school as an electrician. And basically, he did all the electric work at Jay Sebring's house. So Jay Sebring calls him and he's like, hey, the power just went out. Can you come and see what the issue is? And he couldn't make it that night. And so he's like, you know, I can't make it there right now, so I'll come whenever. And so they decide to go do something else, right? So obviously the next night they get murdered. His J.C. Sebring's lawyer sends his son down to his house to get a suit for the funeral. And while he's there, he's like, let me check out the electric. And this is from Tom O'Neill, the book of the Chaos book, just to give credit where credit's due. Basically, he walked around he circled the house, and he saw that the wires were cut with like a serrated blade.
Yeah.
Meaning like it wasn't the Cielo House target to send a message to Terry, because somebody, unless it's a complete coincidence, obviously, that like somebody cut the power to that, you know what I mean? Like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. So that group or somebody in that group was targeted for some reason.
Right.
I think it could be safe to say if you follow the trend of violence, it's like drug related. Potentially, maybe somebody in that group had some connection to that world.
And yeah, I mean, that's interesting because, like you said, the next day they're all murdered. But I don't think many people know about that little tidbit that you just said there.
I mean,
yeah,
I had never heard that.
Yeah. So I'm gonna just throw some Charles Manson questions out at you. This will there will definitely be a part two about Charles Manson. There's so much to cover. I mean, there's so many documentaries that just tells you a lot. But we'll definitely touch on this again down the road. But there's a couple questions I had lingering in my head. So first things first, what did you think of Aquarius with David Duchovny playing? I guess he wasn't playing Charles Manson, but he was going after Charles Manson in a TV show.
You know, I only saw parts of it, and I wasn't really into it. So I don't have an opinion of the overall series.
It's kind of a slow show. Do you think Charles Manson has any kids?
He definitely has kids. One committed suicide. You know, I think a few are just trying to stay out of the public. There was one that was trying to get, I think, some of his life rights back when he passed away. I don't remember the entire story there, but something like that. Google that, because I could be slightly off, but that's the...
And Charles Manson had a girlfriend when he was in prison, and the girl said, whenever you die, I wanted to have your body or something like that. And he's like, I'm not going to die. I'm going to live forever. That's interesting because he ends up dying not too long after.
Yeah, he wasn't psychic apparently.
Yeah. Do you think that because of this cult that happened, a lot of the governments now look, or a lot of the judges and all that now look to the Manson family to try and avoid that? So now you see a lot with cults. They're getting like all these cult leaders get like the craziest amount of time in prison. Do you think it really comes back all the way to the Manson family and they want to try and avoid that?
I don't know. I mean, you know, the one thing about their trial, to get a conviction on Manson, which ultimately is a good thing, like he wasn't exactly helping out the world on the outside.
Yeah, true.
Or making situations better. It's like the kind of prominent helter-skelter theory was there and argued and won, and so that became history.
Yeah.
The problem is, like, if some of these other things were going on in tangent or, like, I don't know, just... Yeah, it's like you never get to know like the actual story. It got all like obscured because of that. And you know, on one hand, you could argue it's a good thing. On another hand, it's like there's some dilemmas with it. But it definitely changed, you know, the world overnight.
How long do you think the Manson family stayed at that ranch until they all disbanded?
It's a good question. I don't recall. I mean, they were definitely there throughout the filming of that Manson doc, so you could see what life was like there post-trial. I can't imagine they would have stayed there that long after the trial just because of how public it was, but I would imagine they would have gotten kicked off. I don't probably read about that, but I don't remember.
And then they all went to live their normal life and work at Starbucks.
Probably, yeah. There's a few you can't find, like no matter how hard you try, so.
How many people do you think they killed?
So you remember that there was this whole thing at Spahn Ranch where they were looking for more bodies.
Yeah.
I had to sign an NDA for something, and I can't really say, but I would look at that.
Yeah.
With a closer attention to detail.
Okay, so lastly, we got to end this epic episode with an epic song. But what song would you like it to be?
Oh, Neil Young, Revolution Blues, baby.
Revolution. And is there anything last you'd like to tell the audience?
Follow me on Instagram and Twitter if you'd like, at Sean Elitis. Or you can listen to my podcast. It's brand new, Astral Noise, wherever podcasts are available.
And what's the key to happiness?
Experience.
Good call.
I want to thank Sean for being on my show. I want to thank Krabby Cookie Company for sponsoring this show. And, you know, I'll see you. Same place, same time. And we out.
This show was brought to you by the amazing Crummy Cookie Dough Company. Check them out in Uptown Waterloo. Great raw cookie dough with ingredients you recognize and respect.